Okay, we are live. Just make sure we are live correctly. Test. Okay. Well, you can hear me anyway. So today we're going to do another Dhammapada. So I get this all set up properly.
Pante, did you want to have the earbuds in during the Dhammapada?
No. See, that's why I need a team. Okay, I think we're ready to go. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 107, which reads as follows. Yo cha vasasatang jantu aging paricare vane e kancha bhavitatanang muhutampi pujaye sayeva pujana seyo yanche vasasatang hutang, which means, And whatever being might, aging parikarchare vane, live in the forest, tending to a fire. And so one might live in a forest for 100 years. Ekancha bhavitatta nang, this is the same as yesterday's verse. Muhutampi pujaye, if one should pay homage to one who has developed themselves just for one moment. Sa yeva pujana seyo, this puja is greater than the one who for 100 years practices this sacrifice, fire sacrifice. Now, not a terribly meaningful verse for those of us who aren't familiar with living in the forest tending to a fire, but we can generalize and talk about it. The story as well is quite similar to yesterday's. It's almost identical. The difference here is the Sariputta, instead of going to talk to his uncle, he goes and talks to his nephew. And he asks his nephew, his nephew is also a Brahmin. His whole family, of course, was Brahmins. He says, King Brahmana Kusalan Karosi, what sort of wholesomeness or good deeds do you do? And so he says, oh, every month, right, Mase Mase Ekang Ekang Pasung, every month I kill having killed a pasu, a livestock, like a pet of some sort, some kind of domesticated animal or some animal. A sheep, maybe a goat, probably. Aging paricharami, I use it to tend to a fire or burn it in a fire, maybe make a burnt offering. It sounds like he just burns it in a fire. Kind of an Abrahamic sort of practice. It's what the Jewish people would do. It's very similar. But fire sacrifice seems to have originally been burning goats and so on all over the world. Somehow this was a big thing to do. And then he says, "Why? For what purpose do you? Kimatang ewang karosi? For what purpose do you do that?" And he says, "Oh, for same as before. Oh, for the." Brahmaloka mago kireso, I have heard, or it is said, that this is the path to the Brahmaloka. And Sariputta says, who told you that? Same as yesterday, same as last time. And again, it was my teachers. So for last one, it was easy to kind of get a sense that his teachers were these naked ascetics. Last time, right, he was giving every month 1,000 pieces of money worth of food or whatever, maybe even just money, directly to these naked ascetics. And so one would think that they were probably his teachers who were teaching him this. Now, in this case, the question is, you know, why are his teachers teaching such things? There's various reasons, and we can extrapolate this to sort of generalize in terms of religion. Why do people teach such ridiculous things? I mean, it's understandable why people believe them. We just tend to believe things based on tradition or based on the authority of our teachers, even though we ourselves have no sense of the causal relationship. So this is why religions do such a wide array of practices, because we're just told to by our priests or by our leaders. The question is, why do the leaders teach such things? Sometimes it's just for gain. I mean, I've seen it even in Buddhism. People come to the monasteries, the temples, and they ask the teacher, you know, what should I do? Someone passed away, what should I do? And I've seen teachers, I've seen monks, you can just see the wheels turning in their head, kind of in a bit of panic, like, scrambling to find something that looks or sounds kind of mystical. I mean, it really comes down to that, just making something up on the spur of the moment to appease people's desire for some ritual, something to solve their problems. Sri Dhammika, a very wonderful sort of populist Buddhist monk and teacher from Sri Lanka, he said that someone asked him about these amulets that monks give out, and he said, well, they have absolutely no meaning, but he said sometimes for people who are new or who don't really have a good understanding of cause and effect, you have to give them something. So he took a pen and he says, you see this? I want you to keep it, hold on to it, and it will keep you safe. He says, sometimes you have to do that. It's a sort of like Dumbo and his feather, if you ever saw the Disney movie. Sometimes people need their magical feather. So there is a defense of it. But I don't think it's a very strong defense, especially when it becomes one's main, absolutely no defense, when it becomes one's main religious practice. And not only is there no defense, but it's blameworthy when it involves unwholesome, clearly unwholesome acts. Like, it's one thing to tell people that offering food to a statue is going to be to their benefit, or pouring water on the root of a tree is going to do this or do that. I mean, that's kind of innocent. And who knows, maybe the angels will get involved and help out with it if they, you know, there's this interesting thing. Buddhists in Sri Lanka are very keen to pour water at the roots of the Bodhi tree. So they pour water to water the Bodhi tree. They'll go around, and it's a very important ceremony. And they do this with the understanding that it leads to pregnancy. And it apparently has some measure of success. I mean, it's anecdotal, and scientists may be able to study it and find that, in fact, there is no correlation. But it's an interesting idea that there might be some correlation, because how would that relate to the Buddhist teaching? It's certainly not a Buddhist teaching that such a thing is possible. And yet we have in the Dhammapada stories, remember the first story that we did, I don't know if I actually brought up the whole backstory, but this guy does basically that. He goes to a tree and he cleans up around this great tree in the forest and puts up banners and flags and a wall around it to protect it, and then makes a promise to the tree that if he gets a son or a daughter, he'll come back and pay great homage and respect to the tree. And sure enough, his wife gives birth right quite quickly after that. So people from Sri Lanka have told me that this actually works. And I was trying to figure out exactly how it might work in reality, because there has to be a causal relationship. It can't just be magic. There's no such thing, and it's not accepted in Buddhism. So the idea that somehow you could do some ritual and that then it could work. The only way it could work, and I'm thinking it actually could, is if the angels got involved. See, because There's got to be something to do with angels hanging out at the Bodhi tree. And if the lay people come to the Bodhi tree and they do this and they make a sincere wish and they have a sincerely good heart, it's kind of like the angels can look down and say, oh, those are nice people. Well, my lifespan is almost up. I think maybe they even hang out looking for parents. And when the angels know that their lifespan is almost up, they try to find suitable parents to go and be reborn in. I mean, something like that. Somehow the angels, the devas get involved. But I give that only as an example of how there might be some causal relationship. But yeah, there has to be something like that, or else it's just ridiculous. And so for the most part it is, especially. It's beyond ridiculous when it comes down to killing animals, killing your fellow living beings, and saying that's somehow the path to the Brahma world. So Sariputta rightly says to him, he says, who taught you? Your teachers. And he says, your teachers haven't a clue. And so the reason why the teachers might have been teaching, it may have just been because, you see, if you sound like you know what you're doing, but if you set up all these complex rituals, people think, oh, well, this person, we need him because he leads us in these very important rituals, and only he knows the right rituals, when in fact they just make them up. And so I think that's what you get. I'm pretty sure that's what you get in a lot of the rituals at the time of the Buddha and even after the Buddha, but definitely very much before the Buddha came around. Like, we studied these in university when I was taking Indian religion many years ago. And some of the rituals are just silly. Like, it seems like originally they were horrific, these horrific sacrifices, a lot of killing. And so they would take a goat up to the altar and cut its head off. And there was something about burying a live turtle under the altar, just burying it alive and killing it, suffocating it under the altar. I mean, for no reason. I mean, why would you bury a live turtle under a stone altar? But it was an important part of building the altar. And then there was butter that had to be poured into the fire and that kind of thing. And it evolved so that eventually, probably with the advent of Buddhism, Jainism, and a lot of the movements that were anti-torture, anti-cruelty, eventually, by the time we came to the form that we study it today, what they do is they bring a goat to the altar and they have to show the altar to the goat. Like, the goat has to see the altar, and then they take the goat away. There's a sacrificial pole, there's a special wooden pole that has to be there as well, and they have to bring the goat and show the goat that pole. So as long as the goat sees the pole, they've done enough, and then they take the goat away. And you can imagine some guy saying, oh, well, we can't kill them anymore. Well, let's just tell everyone, oh, it's enough that the goat sees the pole. I mean, it's something that they just come up with. Say, oh, no, no. People say, well, we don't really want to kill the goat. Oh, well, it's okay as long as he sees the post. Somehow that's meaningful. It's no longer about killing. So, I mean, good on them that their ridiculous sacrifices have become innocent. That's one step in the right direction. The other thing is they, instead of burying a turtle under the altar, they take a lump of butter and they bury it under the altar. It's a substitute for a live turtle, which is a good thing for all the poor little turtles. But definitely, innocent doesn't mean beneficial, worthwhile. And in this guy's case, he's got real problems with his killing. Every month killing a living being and feeding it to the fire. Like, if it was just butter he was feeding to the fire, then you could say, well, that's kind of innocent. But even still, it's not the way to the Brahma world. So it doesn't have any connection with being reborn as a Brahma, as a god. So it takes him to see the Buddha, and the Buddha, he tells the Buddha what he does, and the Buddha says, you could do that for 100 years every month, and it wouldn't be worth a thousandth part if you were to just pay respect to an enlightened being for one moment. So again, talking about homage. And the Buddha specifies my students. It is a bold claim. And as I said last time, it seems like a bit of a biased claim at first blush, because anyone could say that. Well, of course, everyone's going to say their own students. But it has to be true at some point, you know, if your students are enlightened, and if if your people really are, if you're talking about a group of people who really are enlightened, then the Buddha wasn't afraid of making these bold and sort of bragging claims, boastful claims. Because if you look at it another way, of course, it's leaving you wide open to attack. And the Buddha fully welcomed what he's saying. He's really, it's called the lion's roar. He was really putting it out there. He's making a claim, a boast, and challenge. It's a challenge. You know, prove me wrong. It's basically saying, it's claiming something very, very boldly. And that's really what the purpose and the meaning there is. That's not the Buddha bragging or for to get gain of any sort. I mean, there's no sense that the Buddha even had any need. I mean, even if you don't follow Buddhism, there was no real evidence to support that. I mean, he was well taken care of and well supported. What he's doing is instead making just this bold claim that could then be challenged, and of course the Brahmin would have to be impressed by that because he couldn't challenge it. And looking at the Buddhist monks, he would have to agree that, well, yes, indeed, there's something special about many of these monks who have developed themselves. And so that's what the verse actually says, bhavitattanam, to one, if you pay homage to one or to those who are of developed self. So again, not to get too much into it, I think the more important aspect of this that differentiates it from the last one is talking about sacrifice, which I've done. But I think we can extrapolate that to talk about religious practices in general. You know, it's not enough that we have a religious practice, and I think there's a lot of this in the world. Just because something is a spiritual practice or a religious practice doesn't make it really all that valuable. And certainly an understanding that the different spiritual practices have different values. So it's not to say that either you're practicing to become enlightened or you're doing useless things. There are certain religious practices that are valuable, but just not as valuable. So feeding a sacrificial fire is pretty useless. But practicing loving kindness, for example, is quite valuable. Practicing charity, giving money to the poor, is valuable. It's less valuable than, well, for example, paying homage to one who deserves it. But even paying homage to one who is worthy of homage is far less valuable than actually becoming worthy of respect yourself. My teacher said that. He said, going to see an enlightened being or paying homage to an enlightened being is not worth the smallest part of practicing to become an enlightened being yourself. It's in a very famous talk that he gave on the four Satipatthana. He made that very important statement. That yeah, it's good, but it's not worth the smallest part. It's far less good than actually practicing to become one yourself. So it's a matter of degrees, and that's something for us to keep in mind in our spiritual practice, that some people will put a lot of emphasis on chanting, some people put a lot of emphasis on charity or social work, and it's all about our priorities. Some people put a lot of emphasis on study, and in the end we have to ask ourselves, what is our goal? And we have to do those things to engage, put primary emphasis on those things that lead us to that goal. If we're just giving and giving and giving, what is the purpose of that? If we're just chanting and chanting or this or that, what is the purpose of all these things? And on the other hand, if we do have a set purpose and we do things for that purpose, we have to differentiate between those things that actually lead to the purpose. But then there are a wide array of things that can help us, that can actually be of benefit to help us realize our goals. Like charity can be useful for meditation. Morality, of course, is essential for meditation. These kind of things. Study is also quite important, but putting them in context. You know. So many religious practices have to be taken as a support rather than a main goal or a main practice, a main focus. Anyway, things to consider. It's just some of the ideas that arise based on this verse. And the importance of quality rather than quantity. You can do a lot of deeds, but it doesn't make any of them good or worthwhile. You can work for 1,000 years, for 100 years, work very, very hard, and have nothing to show for it, or meaningless things to show for it. Whereas you can just for one moment do the right thing and have it worth far more than those 100 years. That's basically what's being said. A very useful teaching. Anyway, so that's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you for tuning in. Wishing you all the best. So that's that. Just give me a second. I'll put that in. I can have it because it has to convert. So just a second. So, on to the Dhamma portion, the general Dhamma portion of the night. Does anyone have any questions?
There are questions. Okay. Dear Bhante, there is only
just
one
give me a second. Sorry, just give me a second.
Sure.
Turn some things off. That does, doesn't it? And now, one more thing. What was that? 107, right? It works for me. Okay, questions.
Okay. Dear Bhante, there is only one Dhamma group near where I live. I've meditated with the group maybe 5 times now. I like the people there, but I'm not sure going there has been good for my practice. My original hope was that there would be a few people on the similar path as I've been set on by your videos and Mahasi books. I don't want to complain or anything, but unfortunately, it's become obvious that all the people in the group either have only mindfulness-based stress reduction goal or just the simple goal of cultivating calmness. Obviously, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with all those things, but I think the practice can go so much deeper than that, as you often talk about. I feel like the few times I've opened up a little bit about my understanding of insight meditation, which is the understanding that I've cultivated from your videos, everybody has found the things I say really intimidating and contrary to what they would like to think the practice is about. But as I said, I really like the people and kind of get intoxicated by their company, which in a way pulls me away from the practice. Should I keep going there? And the next time I go, what would be the best things to say, talk about to the group, or should I just stay quiet? Sorry, Robin, for making you read such a long question. Best wishes.
It's a good question, no? I mean, this from the sounds of it, I think you may be a little bit overreacting. I mean, it's just a personal. I don't actually know, because based on what you're saying, you could be overreacting, could be underreacting, you could be, you know, they could actually be lynching you every time you say it, but you're just playing it down. But most likely, I mean, in most cases, we get too gung ho and maybe push a little too far and put a little bit too much stress on things that are scary, like nirvana and non-attachment and that kind of thing. Which you don't really have to do, because really that it's all about reducing stress, and it's just a corollary that if you reduce it enough, it eventually all goes away. You see, I mean, it's all how you approach it and how you. Present it. Now, it doesn't seem to me to be a valid problem if people are just interested in reducing stress. All you have to do is be clear about how deep that goes and help people to see that, well, you know, if your goal is to reduce stress, well, look at that stress that you still have. It's a sign that you're really not going quite deep enough. So, hey, maybe this practice will help you go deeper. But even still, you don't really do that. I mean, I never really would point out to someone, hey, look, your practice is inadequate. It would more be like if they come to you and say, you know, I'm not sure why, but my practice isn't, you know, I'm not able to get deeper in my practice. Well, then I would say, well, maybe you could try this practice. Maybe it works better for you. It would only be if they approach you. You don't really try to point out other people's faults and flaws. Now, what might become a problem is if people are only superficially interested in the Dhamma, that will show itself in other ways. Like, I've heard at some of these meditation groups, not MBSR, but other groups that are similar, they'll do a meditation day, and then afterwards they'll have alcohol. They'll sit around and drink. You know? That's a real no-no. That's absolutely... stay away from that group. I mean, maybe not stay away, but put some serious caution. And yes, probably stay away. I'll certainly not go out with them after the meditation, but at the very least, make it known that you disapprove. I mean, that's not in line with meditative goals. But they may be frivolous. They may sit around chatting about frivolous things, and that is a problem. So that's what I would focus on more. And if you can focus on those things and just say, you know, I think it's important that, or not even go so far, but just bring up these teachings. Hey, do you guys want to study the Buddha's teaching on morality and on ethics and that kind of thing? And that, I think, is enough to push people to be more serious about their practice once they see the importance of morality, the importance of non-frivolity, or however you say it, frivolousness. Once they're forced to do that, they'll say, oh, well, then I guess I have to step up my game if the Buddha required more than just us sitting around all day. Because it requires you to be mindful of your desires and your aversions and your delusions. So I don't know, I mean, that's some of my thoughts on it, just to give you maybe some insight. Maybe that helped. But the other thing is, don't be too critical. We often are very, very critical of, we're very easy to get critical of people who are not as into what we're doing, or maybe even more, not as who don't have as much understanding as us. It's easy, at least in the beginning, to look down upon people. Not look down exactly, but become overly parental. I don't know what the right word is, can't think of it, but something like that. Where we feel like we're in a position, condescending it becomes, even though we don't realize we become quite condescending.
There was just a little bit of a follow-up to that. I don't want to sound like I'm better than the other people in the group. I just think my approach to the practice is better due to the effort I've been putting in to try to understand your books and videos and a few Sayadaw books.